From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Who should be next for the U.S. Supreme Court? Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. David Souter's resignation gives President Obama his first chance to nominate a Supreme Court justice. He wants excellence, integrity, and empathy. Does empathy mean that he wants a woman? And if so, why? Conservatives fear he wants a justice who will legislate from the bench. Should the next justice be liberal or conservative? Is there any such thing as non-ideological? Is it time for the first Hispanic? Whatever Obama's choice might be, will Republicans just say no? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Pope Benedict XVI visits the Middle East. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. Liberal or moderate, man or woman, black, white, or brown, should the next Supreme Court justice have judicial experience or a record of service in other branches of government? We'll hear different opinions as President Obama gets ready to pick his first nominee. On Reporter's Notebook, having angered both Muslims and Jews, can Pope Benedict XVI help the peace process by visiting the Middle East? First, this news update. On a day when the latest statistics were made public, President Obama announced efforts to help unemployed people plan for the future.
The idea here is to fundamentally change our approach to unemployment in this country so that it's no longer just a time to look for a new job, but is also a time to prepare yourself for a better job. That's what our unemployment system should be, not just a safety net, but a stepping stone to a new future.
Peter Goodman is New York Times national economic correspondent, author of Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. That's due out in September. Peter, thanks for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, how does the president plan to fundamentally change our approach to unemployment?
Well, as I understand it, what we're talking about is expanding job training. So this is a recognition that things are so out of hand in the job market. We've seen losses of such a great magnitude in some industries, I mean, particularly manufacturing and the auto industry in particular, that we're going to have to figure out how people are going to make a living doing other things, because some of these things are simply not coming back.
There are state laws that make it difficult to get to unemployment assistance if, in fact, you're also getting training at the same time. He seems to want to jawbone governors and others, has asked a couple of cabinet members to do that, and also the vice president's wife.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very complex undertaking in that the way we fund unemployment insurance involves a myriad of different state standards, different state philosophies. But the idea is to pull together governors and local governments and chart a new course where there's some standardization and, you know, where it's okay to get an unemployment check while you're training for something new without taking a hit on the check that you're getting.
Well, let's look at the unemployment statistics that were released today then. 539,000 jobs lost in April. That's an awful lot of jobs, and yet people are saying this is reason to be encouraged.
Yeah, I mean, that tells us something about where we've been, that we get a number like 539,000 negative, which ranks as one of the worst job reports in 30 years, and yet that somehow weighs as a positive. I mean, the truth is that there are some reasons to be hopeful. That's a slowdown in the rate of decline, and before things actually get better, they have to stop getting worse, and that's essentially what's happened.
So elaborate a bit on what you've found and what you've been reporting around the country in terms of unemployment.
Well, it's very, very difficult to get a job. We have a historic number of people who've been out of work for 6 months or longer, and at this point, something like 27% of people who are officially classified as unemployed and drawing unemployment benefits have been there for 6 months or longer. This began with, you know, construction trade, spread to manufacturing. At this point, regardless of what you do, whether you're a lawyer or some other sort of professional, or you work on an assembly line, you're in danger of having your hours cut, you're in danger of losing a job, and if you lose a job, it's awfully difficult to find the next one.
Have a lot of people who have been unemployed for a long time finding their benefits running out?
some, though the extension of benefits has helped a lot. I don't have a firm number, but I mean, we're certainly talking about millions of people who would have been cut off without the extensions of unemployment benefits who are still getting checks.
My understanding that the current picture might be affected by hiring for the 2010 census. Are there that many people involved in counting the number of people in the country?
Well, it's more that there's so little hiring that what hiring goes on is significant. I mean, we saw 611,000 private sector jobs eliminated in April, according to this most recent jobs report. And the reason why the overall net number of 539 comes in lower is largely because of strong government hiring. And a lot of that government hiring is for census.
Often they evaluate and announce a new number after a couple of weeks. Why does that happen so often, and is this number likely to turn out to be more than it's been reported today?
Well, it might be more, it might be less. We don't know. The reason why there's so much fluctuation and revisions are we calculate the unemployment rate based on this household survey where government researchers poll people in different communities. They pick a statistically significant sample, and they ask people, are you working? If you're not working, how long has it been? Are you looking for a job? And the unemployment rate gets derived off of that sample. And as, you know, the modeling gets refined and they plug in variables that they learn about the job market going forward, they revise the data.
Just a couple of minutes left, but summer's beginning. What about teens?
The teen job market is really awful. Last year's market was the worst on record. This year is shaping up to be even worse. The unemployment rate amongst teenagers is 21.5%. Now, there's some complexity there in that, you know, if a teenager who might have once dropped out of school and gone into the workforce now stays in school, you know, that we can all pretty much agree is a good thing. But by and large, teenagers who are out looking for jobs, and particularly this summer, are going to have a hard time finding them because you've got a lot of people who've lost jobs, adults, who are now settling for, you know, the sorts of jobs teenagers once filled.
Peter Goodman with the New York Times. His book coming up in September, Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. Many thanks for being with us. In a moment, who should be next for the U.S. Supreme Court? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. When David Souter announced his resignation from the U.S. Supreme Court, President Obama, who's a constitutional scholar himself, listed some of the characteristics he'll be looking for in his first nominee.
I view that quality of empathy, of understanding and identifying with people's hopes and struggles as an essential ingredient for arriving at just decisions and outcomes. I will seek somebody who is dedicated to the rule of law, who honors our constitutional traditions, who respects the integrity of the judicial process and the appropriate limits of the judicial role.
Dahlia Lithwick is a lawyer. She's senior writer for Slate.com and a contributing editor to Newsweek magazine. And Dahlia, it's always good to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The president said quite a lot. We'll be hearing a little bit more from him later. But much attention has been paid to that word empathy. He said, I view that quality of empathy, of understanding and identifying with people's hopes and struggles as an essential ingredient for arriving at just decisions and outcomes. What are people saying about empathy?
Well, it depends on which people you ask. I mean, first off, this is a word he's been using a lot. He used it on the campaign trail, so this wasn't sort of a slip. He clearly, this means to telegraph something to him, and he's thought about it for a long time. I think there's a couple of different ideas that he compresses into empathy. One is what you just heard. He wants someone from outside the bubble. He's sort of had it up to his eyeballs with jurists who don't know what it's like to try to make ends meet, who've either come up through the ranks of the appeals court bench or through academia, who just don't know what it's like on the ground. So I think there's a piece of it that is, you know, and he said this before, we used to have Earl Warren on the court, a former governor. We used to have people of all different political stripes, and now we just have a very, very monolithic bench. And so I think that's a piece of it. I think the other piece is actually a constitutional point he's making, which is, the conservative wing of the current Supreme Court can tend to be very, very mechanistic, can tend to be very formalistic. They say, look, the law is the law, and we don't care what the outcome is. The case I'm thinking of right now is the Lilly Ledbetter equal pay case that we saw, you know, rectified by Congress. But the idea that you can't listen to cases and say, well, sorry, sucks to be you, but the law is the law. And I think we've heard enough of that, that he's trying to find some kind of doctrinal way to push back at the slightly Dr. Spockian Vulcan flair that the right wing of the bench tends to bring to cases.
A lot of people have suggested that when he says empathy, he's very particularly preparing the way for a woman.
Yeah, I don't think anybody suspects otherwise. It's quite clear that one person on a bench of nine people who's a woman is vastly unrepresentative. I think it's not an accident that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who has tended over her career on the bench to not speak out about being the only woman on the bench, has gone out of her way in the last couple of years, particularly after the Lilly Ledbetter case, has gone out of her way to say she's lonely on the bench. She said the men don't share the same sensibilities. So I think that Ginsburg is calling out a very loud signal that this doesn't work. And I think the country, there's just a general sense that this is so not representative of America to have one in nine jurists that is a woman, that I think Obama's answering to that.
There's no Hispanic on the bench, and there never has been.
It's true. There's no Asian on the bench. There's a whole laundry list of classes of Americans who are not represented on the bench. You know, there's a loud argument being made that we need more people who've actually fought in a war to be on the bench. It's not representative of America, and I don't think anybody wants a Supreme Court that perfectly matches the sort of demographics of this country. But there is a sense, and again, an example is this strip search case that the court heard only 2 weeks ago, where a 13-year-old girl in Arizona was stripped down to her underwear by school officials who were looking for Advil, prescription-strength Advil, didn't call her mom, didn't search her locker, just stripped her down. There was a sense on the bench that you almost had a feeling that some of the justices were saying, oh, this happened to me in the Sigma Nu house all the time. You know, this is Justice Stephen Breyer, a reliably liberal member of the bench, literally said, how is this different from getting undressed for gym class? Again, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, not one to telegraph a gender message, more or less looked over at Breyer and said, you totally fail to comprehend what it would be to be a 13-year-old girl and be strip searched. And so I think there is this feeling that the court is so out of whack with American feelings on gender that needs to be corrected first and foremost.
And the Lilly Ledbetter case, which you mentioned, was about unequal pay. The justices ruled against it on grounds that it was too late to bring the complaint. Sounded very technical to a lot of people. And, of course, Congress changed the law.
Precisely. It was a very, very technical reading of the law that essentially said, look, every woman should know from her first paycheck whether or not she's being discriminated against, and the burden is on her to figure it out. Ginsburg wrote a very, very uncharacteristic, very personal dissent in that case saying this is not how the reality of gender discrimination works. So I think you're starting to see this slight schism on the court between people who say, look, the law is the law, and this is what the letter of the law says. We can do no more. And people on the court who are saying, there's more to do being a jurist than just calling balls and strikes. And so that's a little bit of the tension that I think Obama is pressing when he talks about empathy. But again, he opens himself to huge criticism that he's calling for judicial activism. There's been criticism that that means he wants a jurist who will favor the poor over the rich, favor women over men. I don't think that's built into the word empathy, but it's certainly a very fraught word.
Let's talk a bit about the difference between the decisions that are made by women judges and those that are made by men. Christina Boyd is political scientist at Washington University in St. Louis, co-author of a report into the quantitative voting of judges on the U.S. Courts of Appeals from the early 90s through 2002. Christina Boyd, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
What did you find? We just heard that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has made some very personal comments in decisions about gender discrimination in particular, and, of course, the issue of the 13-year-old girl being strip searched. What did you find in your study?
Well, sure. So as you said, that we actually study the U.S. Courts of Appeals. So these are the federal appellate courts that are right below the U.S. Supreme Court. And in our study, we look at 10,000 votes of the male and female judges in 13 different areas of the law. So we're looking at a lot of different areas, from sex discrimination to capital punishment cases. And we actually find that in most of the areas, there's no difference between male and female judges. But there is an area, and that's sex discrimination cases. And in that area, we find quite a difference. And so this is a difference between both how male and female judges vote and also how the presence of a female judge affects the voting of the male judges on the bench. And so in these sex discrimination cases, we find that female judges are about 10% more likely than male judges to vote in favor of the party claiming sex discrimination. And then we also find that male judges deciding sex discrimination cases with a female judge were about 15% more likely to vote in favor of the original plaintiff claiming discrimination than when they decided the case just with male judges.
So that's a pretty significant difference.
It sure is.
What about ideology? Does that have any impact at all?
Well, you know, in this study, it's a statistical study, and so we're able to control for ideology. So we account for the ideology of the judges. So that means that we're comparing two judges, a male and a female, that have exactly the same ideological preferences. And so when we do that, we still see this large difference in these sex discrimination cases.
How do you measure ideological preferences?
How do we measure them? So they're measured based on the president that appoints the judges and also on the senators. So the senators from the home state of the judge, from where they come from.
On the other hand, though, isn't it true that often the president appoints a judge? This certainly was the case with Justice Souter, who turns out to be pretty different from what he anticipated.
Well, that's right. I mean, once in a while there's an error, but the measurements for ideology actually tend to be very accurate. And so Souter is really somebody that sticks out as an exception.
Based on your study with regard, you found that only in sex discrimination cases did you see very much of a difference. What about other cases involving women's issues, a very particular abortion?
Well, that's interesting because cases like abortion and even sex harassment cases, we didn't find a difference. And so in those cases, we didn't find that male and female judges decided cases differently from one another. And we also didn't find that the female judges were acting as an influence on those judges. So it's really just in the sex discrimination cases where we're seeing a difference between the male and the female judges in their voting behavior.
Again, Christina Boyd, political scientist at Washington University in St. Louis. Dahlia Lithwick, back to you. Are you surprised by those results?
I'm not surprised. I think that one of the very, very interesting and probably understudied aspect of the way courts work, and that's why Christina's study is so exciting, is the role of influence, how one jurist influences another. And it's sort of something we know anecdotally. Sandra Day O'Connor has often spoken about how much Thurgood Marshall colored her view of the world, shaped her jurisprudence. There's a real sense, I think, that jurists have a tremendous effect on one another by telling their stories, by sharing their own experiences. I don't think anyone wants to suggest that men simply don't get it about gender discrimination, but I think that the idea that they could sit on a panel with a woman and have a woman say, stop, here's what it's really like, and they could hear that, that's so tremendously important, and I think it's really not been studied, the ability of sort of telling stories, of narrative, of explaining, of sort of slow walking someone through an experience they may not have lived through. So to me, I think what's really intriguing about this study and about this whole field of study is that we can start to think about how one jurist influences another that is beyond the idea that we need X number of women or X number of Asians or X number of Hispanics on the court. What we need is people who are able to listen and learn from one another, and that's, I think, very profound.
Dahlia Lithwick, again, legal writer for Slate.com and Newsweek magazine. Kurt Levy is an attorney, executive director of the Committee for Justice. That's an organization in Washington advocating for constitutionalist justice, judges, rather. We're going to find out what that means. Kurt Levy, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
And let me go back to the beginning of our program where Dahlia Lithwick talked about this word empathy that we heard the president use and said, first of all, that what it seems to mean is people who are outside the bubble and very particularly people who might, as we've heard her and Dahlia Lithwick suggest, be guided in part by their own personal experiences. Is there anything wrong with that?
Well, you know, being outside the bubble, no. Being guided by your own personal experiences, if it causes you to favor one party or the other, if, you know, a male judge's experience causes him to favor the defendant in a sex discrimination case, and a female judge's perspective causes her to favor the plaintiff. No, I don't think that's good. I think judges should be like him, umpires. And that's sort of the best interpretation of empathy. You know, under a more realistic interpretation of empathy, and because remember, Obama followed empathy with a list of certain groups: empathy for teenage mothers, gay people, the disabled, old people. You know, as words, those sound great, but imagine if you went into a courtroom and the judge said, I have a lot of empathy for your opponent. I really sympathize with his struggle. You would not want to be in that courtroom. You want a judge who is impartial. And Dahlia said that, you know, she doesn't want a judge who just calls balls and strikes, but that seems to me the fairest thing. I mean, you want a judge who will be not ignorant of the world around him. I mean, an umpire behind the plate is not ignorant of the rules of baseball, not ignorant of what's going on in the field, but he's a neutral arbiter. You don't want an umpire who says, you know what, the Yankees have won so many times, the World Series, you know, Seattle, you know, let me give them a little bit of a break. They deserve to win a World Series. That's not what you want in an umpire. That's not what you want in the judge. And, you know, Obama, I think, means yet something else with empathy. I think to some degree it really is a code word for judicial activism. If he means empathy for whole classes of people, that you should decide cases not based on the litigants before you, but what you think would give the best result for society, then judges are making policy, and that is judicial activism. All these decisions should be left up to the democratic process. Of course there should be empathy in the law, but that should be determined democratically. And that was, for example, in the Ledbetter case. Congress said, we don't think that the current state of the law shows enough empathy for victims of sex discrimination, and they changed it. That's the democratic way. You know, so this is really about democracy and power. Do you want judges, unelected judges, a handful of unelected judges, to be the people deciding who gets empathy?
Let me interrupt you. Sure. You said that consideration for what's best for society ought not to be what justices are concerned about. But isn't justice their goal? And are you suggesting that justice might sometimes be bad for society?
No. The goal of deciding what's best for society in the law is up to the elected branches, the executive and the legislature. The reason, I mean, again, it sounds wonderful. Judges should decide what's best for society. But the problem is that is just a cover for absolute power for judges, because one judge will think it's best for society to have abortion easily available. Another judge will think it's best for society to have no abortion. Some judge will think it's good for society to have gay marriage. Another judge will think it's good for society not to have gay marriage. So what you really mean, again, superficially it sounds wonderful, but what it really means is judges get to impose their values on everyone else. It's a very elitist process and very undemocratic.
Kurt Levy, attorney, executive director of the Committee for Justice, organization in Washington advocating for constitutionalist judges. We're going to be back in a moment on our reporter's notebook. We'll talk about Pope Benedict XVI arriving in Jordan with a message of peace. Back in a moment with this conversation on To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about who the next Supreme Court Justice should be, but what characteristics the next Supreme Court Justice should be. Here's a little bit more about what President Obama thinks.
I will seek someone who understands that justice isn't about some abstract legal theory or footnote in a case book. It is also about how our laws affect the daily realities of people's lives, whether they can make a living and care for their families, whether they feel safe in their homes and welcome in their own nation.
Douglas Kmeck is professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University in Malibu. He served as head of the Office of Legal Counsel for Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. He was a supporter of President Obama in the recent election. Good to have you back on our program.
Warren, good to be with you.
What do you draw from what we just heard from President Obama, and how would you compare your views to what we just heard from Kurt Levy, who says this sounds to him like a recipe for activist judges who impose their own views instead of ruling according to the law?
Well, I think this is going to be a game-changing appointment. Some people have gotten complacent about it, saying, well, it's going to be substituting one liberal voice for another, but I think the richness of your discussion already indicates how it will change. Quite obviously and simply, it's likely to be a younger justice. It's likely to be a more intellectually vibrant justice. And as Dahlia mentioned, that's going to make a difference in and of itself in terms of the internal deliberations of the court, just in terms of challenging some of the presuppositions and the complacency of the existing lineup on the court. In terms of empathy, I think this is something that, if properly understood, is a very important criterion. It's not partiality. It's not, as some would criticize it, deciding in favor of the rich or the poor or the black or the white. Empathy is not partiality, but it's also not indifference. It's having enough experience in the fullness of law practice and in the different ways in which it is the law is applied and affects individual lives, whether it be in the context of saving someone's home from foreclosure or working through a bankruptcy or helping somebody start a business. You know, quite right now we've got 9 people on the court who have a very high skill set, but it's all very narrow. It's on the formation of legal doctrine in a very kind of bookish sense. And I think the president wants to expand that, as has been mentioned by your other guests, both in terms of the experience, but also in terms of exploding the notion that there isn't judgment involved. And that's where I would disagree with my friend Kurt. Kurt makes it sound as if it's a mechanical process, as if it is just the ball and strikes. Well, any umpire would tell you who's familiar with baseball, which I won't pretend to be, that there's a great deal of interpretation going on in terms of that strike zone, in terms of the way balls are credited as a striker or a ball, and as a result, there's judgment involved. And that's what the president is, I think, saying, that we've got a court that has told us that there's only one way to think about the law, and it's the way that James Madison thought about it in 1787 in the dictionary that he was using. In point of fact, that's a good place to begin because you want to know what the intent of the founders were, but you also want to know what the impact of the law is in the here and now, the consequences of the law for the people who are living in 2009. And the concept of empathy not only reaches out to these broader population and training skills of different people, but it also challenges this ideology that has set into the court that has narrowed it so much.
Again, Doug Kamek served in the Office of Legal Counsel for Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, also wrote a piece called The Case for Empathy in America for the National Catholic Weekly. Kurt Levy, let me go back to you. Are you advocating for indifference on the part of judges?
No, I'm not. And again, part of what Doug was talking about is understanding life. I certainly would not want an umpire who had been locked away and had no ability to judge whether a runner was purposely interfering with the ball that was hit or not. So yes, there's all kinds of room for understanding life and understanding people's motivations, etc. But again, once you get into the more common definition of empathy, you don't want a judge who lets his feelings get in the way. And again, it's not because feelings are bad, but it's because it's a license for unbridled power for the judiciary. Because once you follow your feelings, you can reach any conclusion. And, you know, for those out there who think that, you know, the judiciary branch should make all the big moral and legal decisions in our society, then I guess empathy is good. But for those who think that, you know, especially on moral issues, that it should be the values of the public, not of a tiny unelected elite, then empathy of that kind is not good.
Douglas Kamek, your take on that issue?
Well, I actually think I have a partial agreement, but I also think that their empathy is attuned to those places in the law where the law should not speak, where, in fact, the Constitution is silent, where the democratic process has no business making moral decisions for the general population because no consensus exists on particular moral subjects, and they ought to be determined in the family, or they ought to be determined in one's chosen religious practice, if any. And as a result, there are, let's just get down to some specific cases that have been mentioned. Mentioned has been this case of Lilly Ledbetter, and Kurt indicates, well, isn't it wonderful that the democracy came to her aid? This is the woman who was discriminated against, and the discrimination was hidden, and she didn't file a timely lawsuit to get recovery. And ultimately, the Congress of the United States did come to her rescue. But I would point out in that case that the superb reasoning of Justice Alito, to me, illustrated not that the precedents decided the matter, but that they didn't decide the matter, that in fact they were indeed quite at war with each other, that the language of the statute needed to be interpreted one way or the other, in favor of the enforcement of civil right or against it. And if one is, I think, empathetic with the overall goal, the democratic goal that had been embodied in that statute, that the judicial outcome would have been exactly the outcome that Congress said they had intended, that they wanted all along. Now, Congress can't be sitting like the schoolmarm at the arm of the justice, always correcting their work. We have to rely upon the justice to give a full-bodied interpretation of civil rights law or business protection law, whatever the subject may be, as the law has been written. Let's take one other case very quickly, guns. In the last term, there were two historical cases made for about the Second Amendment. 5-4, the Supreme Court decided that the District of Columbia didn't have the capacity to regulate guns in the way that they had provided. Now, that came at the expense of the first 13 words of the Second Amendment that seemed to relate the gun right to militia service. Now, that was a quite, whatever way one comes out on that, that was a very controversial decision. Now there's a further controversial decision. Is it going to be extended to apply to the states so that the states are not, so that the states don't have the leeway to address very high rates of gun violence within their communities? This is not something where there is a certain answer. It requires discernment and judgment on the part of the judge. And the democracy has indeed delegated that responsibility to the judge. So again, my difference with Kurt is not with respect for democracy, but the recognition that in some circumstances the Democratic Republic has made assignments for this judgment to the judiciary, and we need to have a broader range of training and philosophy than that which presently exists on the Supreme Court.
Kurt Levy, back to you, not so much on the two cases, although you may want to refer to them, but on this issue of whether or not, in fact, the Constitution does delegate, and the people have thus delegated to the courts, this question of judgment to settle the issues once and for all.
Well, I disagree. If you look at the Constitution, it delegates to the judiciary the right to decide cases and controversies, not to make policy decisions. Now, you know, again, it's easy to describe Ledbetter in a way that makes the answer seem obvious, but there's a reason for statutes of limitation. It's because if people take too long to file claims, the evidence, the witnesses become stale. And so the legislatures have balanced sympathy for the victim with the need to have claims be expedited. And is it appropriate for a judge to come in and say, oh, but I so feel for Lilly Ledbetter that I'm going to override the judgment of the elected legislature? That's where Doug and I disagree.
Well, but Doug Kamek, is that what the court was saying, that we really feel for Ledbetter, or were they saying something else?
I think they were saying something else. Of course, there are purposes for repose, which is what is the policy purpose underneath the statute of limitations. But I think what we have there in that case were two bodies of precedent, one that recognized that there have always been exceptions to the application of the statute of limitations where the discrimination had been hidden from view and where the unfairness of that hiding of the essential facts that give rise to a plaintiff stating a cause of action is taken into account. And there had to be a sense about the court as it made its decision as to whether the law had definitively come down on one side or the other, whether it came down on the strict file within 120 days, it doesn't matter how the evidence had been hidden from you, or the discrimination had been hidden from you, or we're going to allow a common sense leeway to file when those facts are known. And they made a choice. They made a choice based upon their own judgment, not a choice based on the words of the statute or on a definitive case. And that's my point. We hire judges to exercise that judgment.
All right. Obviously, this is a disagreement we are not going to resolve on this program, but you've both eloquently laid it out, and we appreciate it. I want to raise another issue that Dahlia Lithwick referred to earlier on, and that is the question of being outside the bubble. Let me just read briefly from an editorial in the Austin American-Statesman editorial. While the court is divided between liberals and conservatives, its 9 members are remarkably alike in too many ways. 8 of them graduated from Harvard or Yale law schools. Not only did all 9 justices serve as federal appeals court judges, 7 of them served on just 3 appeals courts in Washington, Boston, or Philadelphia. Lithwick, let me go back to you. What's the argument for appointing someone who's never been a justice or a judge at all?
Well, I think the argument is, you know, Robert Jackson, one of the all-time, you know, great justices, Earl Warren, one of the all-time great justices. I mean, bracket your politics. And I think it's fair to say what happens to, and you know, this is an interesting problem. In fact, Chief Justice Roberts recently gave a speech in which he said the bench is actually far better for being composed of this incredibly homogeneous group, and that it's much more lawyerly now than it was when all the riffraff was serving. I think he's actually wrong on that point. I think that there's a way in which what politicians bring, and you know, people are talking about Jennifer Granholm as being on the short list,
governor of Michigan.
That's right, or what academics bring who haven't necessarily come up through the Court of Appeals is very enriching because it's a different mode of thinking. It's a different way of operating. If you go back to the original point we were making about persuasion and the need to kind of get 5 people to vote with you, not ideological purity, not pristine vision of the law, but getting 5 votes, there's really something to be said for putting a politician on the court. So, you know, I think reaching beyond the appeals court bench is critical, because what it does is it just brings different modes of thinking and interacting and behaving to a bench that really just has become quite stultified.
Kurt Levy, does that your teeth on edge?
You know, I have no problem with what Dahlia just said. We certainly don't need it to be all Court of Appeals judges, and we certainly don't need them to all be from Harvard and Yale. You know, that makes the court more elitist, and that's exactly what I'm complaining about. My problem with judicial activism is that it's basically the intellectual elite from a few universities imposing their values on the rest of society. So the last thing I want is an elitist court.
Well, what about judicial experience? Should a Supreme Court justice have that or not?
Oh, it's probably good that most of them do, but I don't think it's necessary that all 9 do. I mean, I agree. Multiple perspectives is a good idea.
Okay, so in other words, then, you'd go along with the, or perhaps not on a philosophical basis, but if a governor or somebody else who had been in the political system or an academic were appointed who hadn't had experience on a particular court or on any court, rather, that would be okay with you?
Well, I would want them to have a good legal mind. I wouldn't want somebody who, when they're on the court, acts like a politician. In other words, it's fine for a politician to impose their own values. It's not for a judge. But, yes, I think if they had a good legal mind and applied that legal mind on the court, then the fact that they had experience in other fields would be great.
The Republicans have chosen Jeff Sessions of Alabama to replace Arlen Specter on the Judiciary Committee. That's a conservative for a sort of liberal on the part of Specter. Do you think that means, Kurt Levy, that we're going to see a pretty dogged opposition to whoever the president appoints?
Well, I think a lot will depend on the nominee. If it's a nominee who also believes that empathy for certain favored groups should play a role, we will. But perhaps Obama will surprise us and appoint someone who truly does have bipartisan support. And, you know, in that case, there won't be a fight. Certainly Sessions can is a very, very bright guy, great legal mind, was Attorney General of Alabama, is firm but very calm. If he needs to lead a vigorous opposition, I think he'll do a great job. But I think we'd all like it to be someone we don't have to fight over.
Daniel Lithwick, back to you very quickly, if you will, because we're running pretty short of time here. Who would you like to see the president appoint?
I think I'd like to see, and Doug Kmek hinted at this, someone young, someone who can go toe-to-toe with the really brilliant Antonin Scalia, the really brilliant Chief Justice. Someone, you know, I'm particularly fond of Pamela Karlan from Stanford Law School, Elena Kagan, the new Solicitor General, just somebody who's really going to bring fire and energy and vigor back to the left wing of the court.
Christina Boyd, we haven't heard from you for a long time. You're not a lawyer. You're a political scientist, again, at Washington University in St. Louis, did that study on the voting of judges on U.S. courts of appeals, the differences between men and women and the way they decide certain cases. Do you have a favorite?
You know, I'm actually a fan of Kathleen Sullivan, the former dean of the Stanford Law School.
So how is she different from the woman just mentioned by Dahlia Lithwick?
Actually, she's very similar in her academic background and that different perspective that she would bring to the bench.
Okay, Kurt Levy, back to you with the director of the Committee for Justice. Do you have a favorite?
I think Kim Wardlaw, a Hispanic woman, but has not shown, certainly liberal, but has not shown the tendency towards judicial activism of, say, a Sonia Sotomayor. Kathleen Sullivan, I think, would be disastrous. She's been very active in the gay marriage movement in California. I think she'd have a really hard time being objective on that one, and that is a question that's going to come before the Supreme Court in the next decade.
Christina Boyd, quickly on that particular issue, Kathleen Sullivan was your candidate.
That's right. But I think that her academic background is really something that the court needs, despite this particular issue.
Doug Kmek, back to you at Pepperdine University. What do you think?
Well, all of the names mentioned are talented people. I know Kathleen Sullivan very well, and I think very highly of her. I think she would be the type of nominee that would bring to the internal deliberations great knowledge of the Constitution. I think she brings from her life great empathy with a wide range of people. Her work at Stanford has often been for those who are least advantaged. The notion that she couldn't judge fairly a matter dealing with sexual orientation, I think, is just wrong. We don't say that African Americans can't serve on the court because there might be a civil rights issue, or there women can't serve on the court because there might be a gender issue. So I think actually her nomination in and of itself would be a tribute to the fact that we don't engage in stereotype.
Kurt Levy, quick response just on that particular issue.
Well, yes, her being, I should have gone in more into depth to say that if you listen to her theories about gay marriage, they're very activist theories. The idea that there was a right to gay marriage in the California Constitution is, you know, even for a judicial activist, way out there. So that's what I'm worried about.
Okay. And your nominee, Kim Wardlaw, of course, is a justice of the appeals court in California. Federal Appeals Court. Pardon me. Well, thank you all for being with us. Kurt Levy again, executive director and attorney, Committee for Justice, Douglas Kmek at Pepperdine University in Malibu. Christina Boyd at Washington University in St. Louis, and Dahlia Lithwick with Slate.com and Newsweek magazine. In the year 2000, when Pope John Paul II went to the Middle East, his trip was called historic. This week's visit by Benedict XVI takes place under different circumstances. First of all, peace between Israel and the Palestinians seems more elusive than ever, certainly more than it did in 2000. And Benedict himself has contributed to ill feelings on the part of Muslims and Jews. We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. John Paul II left a note at the Western Wall apologizing for anti-Semitism by Christians. Benedict XVI lifted the excommunication of a bishop who's denied the Holocaust. He also infuriated Muslims by linking the Prophet Muhammad to violence. As he begins a week-long visit, he describes himself as a pilgrim of peace. But the world may be excused for holding its breath. That's according to John Allen, who's senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. And John Allen, thank you very much for being on our program.
Always a pleasure, Warren.
The Pope has arrived in Jordan, as we understand it, and has already had something to say. He was met at the airport by King Abdullah. What can you tell us about it?
Well, I'm here in Amman following the Pope during this week-long visit, and I would say that today Benedict XVI is choosing to spend 3 days in Jordan at the start of this visit. When John Paul came in 2000, he was here less than 24 hours. I think that choice is a clear reflection of Benedict's effort to seem even-handed in his outreach to both Muslims and Jews, and he certainly, I think, got things off on a positive foot today. He had a very warm reception from King Abdullah at the airport. Benedict returned the favor, publicly expressing his deep respect for Muslims, and also thanking Jordan for the basic climate of religious tolerance for Christians here. Even though Christians are less than 3% of the population, they are very prominent in public life. Benedict then went to a center for handicapped youth that is run by the Catholic Church, but whose clientele is almost entirely Muslim. It's a good example of grassroots collaboration. So at least on day one of this trip, he seems to be striking many of the right notes.
Let me refer back to your article, "The World May Be Excused for Holding Its Breath." As I said earlier, you say, if he simply manages to get back to Rome without starting a war, some might declare the trip a success. You then go into four possibilities for him to actually achieve something while he's in the Middle East. Let's see if we can get through them. What's the first?
Well, pressing the Israelis to understand that the two-state solution, that is, respecting the right of the Palestinians to sovereignty, isn't about statecraft or diplomatic negotiating tactics, but it's about justice. And I think Benedict is, in a way, positioned to do that at a level in engaging the kind of religious convictions that shape policy choices in this part of the world that secular diplomatic troubleshooters simply aren't able to do.
How about his ability to persuade the Palestinians to change their situation?
Well, I mean, really, since the beginning of his pontificate, Benedict has been trying to engage global Islam in a conversation about reform. In his language, it's about the need to balance faith and reason. He got off on the wrong foot with that conversation, with that now famous 2006 speech that set off a firestorm in the Islamic world because he linked Muhammad with violence. But that's the conversation he's trying to have. And obviously Palestine, and particularly the rise of Hamas in places like Gaza, gives him an obvious opportunity to raise the subject once again.
So persuading the Israelis then that the two-state solution is a just one would be number one. Getting the Palestinians to reject extremist elements would be number two. What's the third?
Well, giving a shot in the arm to the struggling Christian population here in Israel and Palestine, which is actually more or less on the brink of extinction. At the time of the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, Christians were about 20% of the population in what the Vatican calls the Holy Land, referring to both Israel and Palestine. Today, they're around 2%, and the numbers continue to fall. And that's not just a matter of spiritual or historical concern. Historically, Arab Christians have promoted a pluralistic vision of society, and for that reason acted as a buffer between Islamic fundamentalism and Jewish ultranationalism. So if they vanish, the whole region suffers. And so I think that's another contribution the Pope could make.
You think he can encourage more Christians, Arab Christians, to stay in what the Church refers to as the Holy Land?
Well, I think he can do two things, if you want to get concrete. The first is to persuade the local Christians that the world, and particularly the Church around the world, has not forgotten about them, because many of them have the sensation that it has. I think the other thing that Benedict can do is encourage Christians in other parts of the world, particularly in the affluent West, to support local Christianity here. And that might mean financial contributions. It also might mean coming here on pilgrimage. The tourism industry is obviously beleaguered for a variety of reasons, but if more Western Christians were to come to patronize Christian shops and restaurants and hospitals and hotels and so on, it might help turn a corner.
And finally, your fourth idea is that he might be able to do something with regard to Iran. What is it?
Well, you know, while relationships between Washington and Tehran and Tehran and other Western capitals obviously have to be rebuilt, the Vatican has actually had a regular standing dialogue with a key Iranian ministry since 1996. And further, a lot of scholars of religion will tell you that there's a sort of natural affinity between the Shiite version of Islam that dominates Iran and Roman Catholicism. They both believe in heavenly intercessors. They have very expressive popular devotions, and so on. And precisely because Iran is, in a certain sense, a theocracy, or it at least is a theopolitical society in which you can't talk politics without bringing in religion, the Pope might be able to open a conversation with them in a way that other Western figures simply cannot. So the hope there would be that Benedict XVI could open up a door and leave it up to the Iranians as to whether they want to walk through it.
Yeah, and does his spiritual or nature, his orientation, the fact that he's a religious leader, make him a particularly good person to deal with issues that diplomats and politicians don't always understand?
Well, I think it does, because the reality is that when Western troubleshooters, people like George Mitchell or Tony Blair or whoever it might be, come to the Middle East, well-intentioned, well-informed, very skilled at the level of statecraft, inevitably they're always having half a conversation with the people sitting across the table from them, because the truth is that both in Israel and in Palestine and in the other countries of this region, this simply is not the concept of church-state separation that we have in the West. Religious convictions have heavy influence on policy, and the Pope can talk that language.
John Allen, I know you went to a lot of trouble to be with us, and many thanks to you. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Andrea Brody, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, Gary Scott. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.